So last weekend I was down in Northampton doing a bit of a commission for Northampton Arts Collective. And what we were doing down there is I've been making a poetry map where you go to different parts throughout the city, have your earbuds in, and you'll listen to a poem while you're standing in a place and situation where the poem was written. And as part of this project, we got a chance to bring along our friend Jonathan Pryor, who's a fantastic sound artist. And what he did was he took contact mics and he put them on stones or pieces of metal. He took mics that could hear the electricity in the walls and sounds like that. We got up really early in the morning one morning at 4 a.m. and we listened to the dawn chorus of birds singing to each other. It was totally amazing. It gave me a real appreciation of how sound can recreate a place in a really magical way. He'd kind of take his microphones and stick them right underwater or get them really close to mallards. He played me one audio recording from underwater where he was listening to snails eat. Turns out snails are really loud and there's a constant amount of sound happening as they lick algae with their tongues that have 14,000 teeth just licking and scraping. It's amazing. And so with that in mind, I was really excited to sit down and talk to Thomas Butler, who's done a piece called Elbow Room, and he'll explain it for you. But basically, he's used archival footage from Scottish Screen, sound recordings, as well as his own personal composition to create this piece of artwork. So I was really excited to talk to him about what psychogeography means, how he collected the sounds, and how he came up with this composition. I really enjoyed it, and I hope you do too.
Hello, everybody.
It's the multicolored cultural laser. We travel the world for the boys and the girls. Casting pods of wonder and amazement. Multicolored cultural laser.
My name is Thomas Butler. Elbow Room is a 40-minute piece of music, and it's for ensemble, but it has also video and sound recordings in it. Basically, it tells a story of how contemporary Glasgow was built, you know, how in the 1940s people made a certain plan about how the city should be. That plan didn't work out as the way the architects intended, but certainly some ideas that were within that plan were built, and they kind of still affect our lives today. So I was looking to write a piece of music that kind of reflected that.
And there's loads of multimedia stuff. So we're watching a piece. There's two films from the Scottish Screen Archive, which were...
The first is called Glasgow Today and Tomorrow, and that was made in 1949. And there is another film called Glasgow 1980, which was made in 1971. They're looking forward to 1980. It was made by the Glasgow Corporation in a way to tell the citizens of Glasgow that all the building work and all the disruption to the lives that they're going to experience during the 1970s is all going to make this paradise by 1980. So that's why the film was made, why it was called 1980, and why it was made in 1971.
It's amazing, because I was watching it and just thinking, wow, this is really optimistic. And a level of optimism I don't think we get really to see today. And knowing Glasgow a bit and kind of driving on the motorway and stuff, and I think you capture this very elegantly in the work with some of the sadness and disappointment, I think, that's inherent in some of the parts of the composition. But that optimism was really there, wasn't it?
Yeah, and that's something I wanted to reflect. You know, it's very easy to be cynical about these schemes, because looking back from 2014, you know, with our ideas of conservation and sustainability, the 1945 plan, when it was first made, I think, was to knock Glasgow down and start again. You know, that's basically the plan. That's not an exaggeration. It's actually what was wanted to happen. So, you know, to us today, that just seems like absolute complete madness. But I think the people who wanted to make this plan, you know, had their heart in the right place and wanted to make a much better future for the citizens of the city. So I really wanted to capture that excitement and the fact that this could be, you know, this urban utopia. Unfortunately, I don't know if it materialized quite in the way the planners had intended, but I didn't want to be cynical about it. I wanted to capture that, you know, that excitement and that desire to make a better life for everybody.
Yeah, I love it. They talk about things that are really big and important ideals, like freedom. They talk about the future and the notion that the computer is the future and people won't have to work so hard. Quote unquote, the housewife will have an easier life being able to drive to the market. What would you say has happened between the dream and the reality?
I think the problem is that the dream is a fantasy in a way. The dream was to build a city which was, you know, the 21st century city, which was controlled by computers effectively, and it was full of motorways for easy access for the car, and it was going to be about personal autonomy. So you drive your car from your beautiful functional house to your beautiful functional office, and this will be all very quick and easy. But of course, this ignores the reality of the fact that you have traffic jams and your motorways are so, so noisy. The kind of the realities of living this lifestyle was never gonna ever gonna come true, unfortunately. I mean, it seems like to us, it seems like the planners were very naive about, you know, the reality of living in this urban utopia, this futurist utopia. And there is a kind of futurism about the ideals that they wanted to say. I mean, interesting what you're saying about, you know, planning people's lives. And there's a brilliant quotation from the film that unfortunately we couldn't use, but it talks about planned freedom. And the idea that something is both planned and free, you know, doesn't sit very easily with us. But yeah, there was this almost paternal desire to, you know, help these sorry people with their lives, basically, I think.
Yeah, and I think we, I mean, maybe we don't forget, but there is this, because in the 1940 section, you know, really paints a portrait of Glasgow as super struggling, right? I mean, what was going on at the time then?
Well, at the end of the Second World War, the city engineer, who was called Robert Bruce, he was commissioned to write a report about how Glasgow could best cope with, well, various things. So there was massive poverty in Glasgow. There was terrible housing. There's absolutely no denying that. Also, the projections for the industry in the Clyde, everything assumed that it was going to decline, as indeed it did. So Robert Bruce was charged with not only deciding, you know, what was wrong with Glasgow, but also finding a solution to it, which is how we ended up with this enormous extreme plan to rebuild the city along lines, I suppose, quite like Glasgow has actually gone. So it's now more based around commerce, it's now more based around the financial industry, it's not so much based around, you know, manufacturing and the heavy industry as it used to be on the Clyde. So in many ways the projections were correct, and in many ways many of the problems that Bruce had encountered in the 40s, things like poverty and poor health, I mean, those still exist in Glasgow. I mean, not to the same extent as in the 40s, but there is still a problem with poverty and ill health across the city today.
Yeah, but can a city plan? I mean, is it just totally naive? I mean, I think it would be totally naive now to think actually a city planner can change lives in that way. I think you do see this, though. You do see this in different countries where, you know, developing places where they are still trying this like notion. But I think if they put up a new build in Edinburgh or Glasgow or anywhere, I think we'd be like, yeah, it's very nice, but it's not going to change our lives. You know, they always sell it now. We've planned your freedom. We've built you this beautiful box so you can be totally free and mortgaged to the hilt. We don't believe that anymore, that a city planner could possibly alter our lives.
No, it's now far more subtle. You know, the way that people attempt to change our lives now is all about nudging. You know, it's all about the subtleties of our behavior. But, you know, this is the high point of modernism in the 40s. You know, the idea that it's not just modernist architecture, it's a modernist way of looking at the world, which is very top down. You know, there is a plan for the people, and they act like, I suppose, like little ants in a maze or something. They go about the business and they make the machine work that way. I live in Glasgow, and I had the idea in Glasgow several years ago. I mean, it was actually walking through town, walking along past the motorway, and just wondering how on earth that got there, and who on earth had this idea to build this big multi-lane motorway through literally the heart of the city. It is right in the middle.
Yeah, right on, I guess that's, what's that, near the Mitchell Library and the Art School, that kind of area where you're walking down Saki Hall Street, past all the shops and kind of the old buildings, and then you just get to this bit where you're just like totally confused and you're going to be killed by a car at any moment.
Yeah, exactly. It does crop up, you know, it creeps up on you in the motorway, and it splits the city in two. There's the city centre and the east end on one side, and there's the west end on the other. So when I first moved to Glasgow, I actually lived at the time in the west end and had to walk a lot into the centre. So I crossed this thing at least twice a day. and as a pedestrian, you wonder why this thing is there. And it's very noisy and very loud. And later on, actually, I lived in a flat that was very near the motorway. So it actually, in a way, it kind of sung me to sleep every night, this swooshing of the cars going past. So I really wanted to look into why that was there. And I, you know, just in a very casual way, started looking as to, you know, who designed this and why. And I found it absolutely fascinating. And the thing that I find most fascinating in a way is the fact that these plans, drawn up such a long time ago, they still really affect people on a day-to-day basis in a way that obviously we cannot affect now, because this change has been made, and it is, as far as our lives are concerned, it is for all time. And something that I was interested me in, and why I wanted to write the piece, was that it's a kind of a fantasy of a planner which turns into somebody else's reality that we have to deal with on a day-to-day basis.
When you were researching it, were you coming up against, were you finding stuff about opposition? Were you going out and actively kind of digging into archives, reading newspapers of the time and the period?
Yeah, a bit. Yeah, there was certainly a lot of people who weren't happy with that. I mean, this is probably why the main original plan didn't come to fruition. I mean, the official reason is cost. I mean, as you can imagine, knocking down a city and starting again is an expensive process. But, you know, there were also slightly more conservative views, which should be that, you know, to renovate what we already have rather than to knock it down. I mean, a very simple example, Robert Bruce in the 40s plan, he wanted there to only be two main railway stations in Glasgow, because at the time there were four. And of course, today we only have two. But Bruce's way of dealing with it was to knock down all four and build two. Whereas what actually happened in real life was that we just knocked down two and kept the two that were already there. So it seems like a lot of overkill in the original plan. And I think it was tempered quite a lot by just some more realistic voices saying that this is very unworkable and impractical.
How do you go about approaching sort of composing and presenting this? I know that the performance itself, you really felt like you were part of it. It wasn't just listening to an ensemble, there was video and stuff. But I'm wondering how... Because certainly when I end up doing a commission and you want to look at something historical, it's really hard to sort of find that arc and also to avoid putting too much information in it. Now, obviously, with music, it's different, but did you find yourself hitting a point where you were saturated with reports and images and all these things and wanting to cram them all in and being like, it's only 40 minutes.
yeah, is the answer to that. I found it very hard to think up a suitable approach when I first started this, because, you know, it was the subject area that interested me the most. And therefore, when you sit down and go, right, I need to write a piece of music about this, how on earth do I do it? That was actually quite a hard thing to do. So for me, it was actually the archive films that kind of allowed me to find a way into writing a piece of music about this. And as you suggested, I mean, there has to be room for music in the piece of music. So there is a limit to the amount that you can add in extra to that. You know, the piece had many incarnations when I was writing it. You know, at one point it had 15 short movements in or something. And we ended up with three relatively large movements. And the thing that convinced me this was the right idea was actually how to get from movement to the next movement. So basically the structure of the piece is the first movement looks at the plan for the 1940s, the second movement from the plan that was made in the 70s, and then the third movement is today. You know, there are some nice little touches which I could use from the films that would link the movements together. So the end of the first movement talks about building a new Glasgow, and the second movement begins with the destruction of the old Glasgow. The second movement ends with the optimistic, you see on the film, a car drive to an incompleted motorway ramp. And there's a caption that comes up on the screen that says, "To be continued." And that's from the original 1971 film. But of course, that was never actually continued. That motorway was never built. And so we start in the third movement with today, which is the same ramp, which hasn't been completed at all. It's in the original state it was in the 1971 film.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful, that is a really elegant shift, actually, because it goes, I guess you film right at that same ramp, yeah?
Yeah.
And we just hear the sound of traffic, which is both beautiful, but far more, but also hideous, because in the 1971 version, we've got your soundtrack, we've got this kind of electro motorway craftwork vibe, which is really, again, this just super optimistic, isn't it? That sound of the future, you know, presented to us was so exciting. I want to move to Glasgow in 1980, but but that shift to then just seeing the kind of desolation and the sadness of it was really powerful.
The fact that the 1971 film doesn't have any real life sounds in it was very interesting to me. It's very, you know, it's very voiceover heavy, and the voiceover is very optimistic and telling you how great the new glass is going to be. But as we all know, motorways are really noisy and loud, and that's what we're actually left with at the end of the day. You know, it's unrealistic of these people to suggest anything other than that. And I wanted to bring that, the noisiness of a city back in, you know, because silence in a city is never silence. What we think of a quiet city has all these sounds in the background. And, you know, one of the other elements in this film, as you suggested, was the sound recordings. And I recorded all over Glasgow. I did many, many hours of sound recordings, including in the parks. And there are some very, very beautiful green spaces in Glasgow. But always there was this background traffic murmur that was always there. So I thought that the best thing for the last movement of this piece, as a more realistic depiction of today's Glasgow, would actually to be used that traffic sound, because it is actually omnipresent.
There was a lack of cynicism in the piece, I think, and there was also a lack of anger. Did you consciously avoid anger and cynicism?
Yeah, it was a very conscious decision to do that. I mean, I really like Glasgow. You know, I choose to live there. I mean, you may tell from my voice I wasn't born there. So, you know, I'm not Glaswegian, and I have a lot of respect for the city because it's a fantastic place to live. So I didn't want to appear to be down in Glasgow, because I'm not, genuinely. I wanted to avoid anger because I think that's just the way this is, and we can make stuff better if we want to make it better, but it has to be a conscious choice. There's no point in kind of being angry about the past without wanting to do something about it, I think.
But you do see it, because I was reminded when the second act started, so with all the buildings going down, and also actually in the beginning, because you do see some of these buildings of this proposal that was, you know, was talked about for as part of the Commonwealth Games to blow up in a spectacular fashion, these Red Road flats that were made in 1965 or around there. And people were so angry about it, just immediately, a terrible idea, you know, furious. Did that color this piece at all? Did that debate kind of worm its way in?
Well, the piece had been finished by then. It was just a coincidence that this all happened at the same time. But we were very shocked when we heard about this plan. And I genuinely thought it was an April Fool, because I you know, it was announced in the early days of April, and I thought I just missed it on the 1st. And it wasn't until I saw the petition against the plan that I realized it was a real thing. I think the problem is that the flats, they're so symbolic, and they've got such a complicated symbolism to Glasgow. I mean, they did become a byword for kind of crime and antisocial behavior. So for some, they mean that. For others, they were an amazing home, because all the reports that are written about people who was moving in the 60s, you know, are generally very positive. You know, this was a very good step for many of the people who moved in. They also represent the high point of modernism. They also represent a sense of possibly, you know, disenfranchising the populace by moving them out from, you know, where they used to live, because that's why the Red Road flats were built in the first place. So there are so many different opinions that you can have about these flats. The fact that the organizers of the Commonwealth Games were selling this as a positive, optimistic move. I mean, yeah, maybe it can be viewed as being an optimistic thing, but that's not the only way that destruction can be viewed. And I think it's a lot more complicated than the organizers were imagining.
It's very parallel to that, and to the movement of, say, I guess Bob Moses in New York City, who also bisected New York City and displaced loads of people. But like, to see that happening again must have been so frustrating for people who had lived through it once, right?
Yeah, and also don't forget that this is social housing. You know, we're not in the best economic times at the moment. So when you have people who are better off destroying the houses of those who aren't so well off, you know, it doesn't sit very comfortably.
As a spectacle.
Particularly as a spectacle, in an artistic context. And the thing is, the flats are going to get knocked down anyway. They are doomed. But the fact is that they are, you know, being brought into some kind of almost artistic cultural context, you know, that just made all the symbolism kind of explode more, you know.
Can you tell me a little bit about just the performative aspect of what you do as a composer? Because why is it, do you think, that you feel it's so important to have this kind of theatrical element to the composition?
I think there are several reasons. I mean, the reason for Elbow Room existing in the first place was the fact that as a composer, I feel it's really important to engage with the world around me. You know, that's what I want to do. It's not something which, I don't live in an ivory tower and throw down my pieces of music from there for people to listen to. I really want to engage in what's around me. You know, music is almost, for me, it's a medium rather than a message. You know, the music in itself, even though, of course, there are many wonderful sounds that I like and would want to use in a composition, there has to be a bigger reason behind me writing in the first place, you know. So there's that kind of, I suppose, more social aspect to it. From the purely theatrical point of view, simply because I view music as a performance, and it's a performative art, and therefore using, you know, the other elements of performance, which aren't just the sonic elements, to me are very important. I mean, interestingly, there's been quite a lot of research done recently which suggests that things that we take for granted, things like what the performer is wearing and how they move, this actually has a great deal of impact on how we listen to a piece of music, you know, just as a piece of music. So I'm interested in bringing all that together into a composition and actually making it integral to the piece rather than something which is added on to it afterwards.
Do you ever worry that somehow the music is getting lost, the composition is getting lost amongst all of this stuff? Do you ever worry that, certainly if I'm doing a project that has more than the literary elements or the wordy elements, I sometimes am like, I wonder if I'm covering up some really bad writing by putting this spectacular laser show on top of this, right?
Well, you know, you can cover a multitude of sins. I mean, I try not to do that. But it is a case of balance. You know, it's a case of when one thing is happening, maybe something else can't happen. And it's trying to find the way of letting all these elements in a piece kind of exist at the same time without overwriting each other. And yeah, it's quite tricky to do. It means you have to think of a whole lot of other things you wouldn't have to think of if you're just writing a piece of music. But I find it exciting to do that, to be honest.
Are you excited? How do you feel about bringing the piece over to Glasgow? Because it's a pretty interesting shift to take it from Edinburgh to Glasgow. And of course, people will be a lot more, there's a lot of these images, a lot of these sounds will have a lot more resonance for people there.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been actually quite nice to open in Glasgow. It was just a scheduling thing that meant we couldn't. I'm looking forward to taking it to Glasgow. It's going to, as you said, it's going to mean more to people there because they're going to recognize the things. So there are lots of little elements in the film, in the second movement, which, you know, to us today, we see the same thing happening. For example, a very small example, there is a shot in the second movement of a building being built and, you know, an optimistic thing. But actually, that building is currently being rebuilt in Glasgow as of today. So, you know, I was going to almost put that in the last movement, but then I decided against it. But we know that that's happening. So there's more of a context there. You know, I think this piece would, I'm not sure how it would fare in another country. You know, I'm not sure even if I took it to London, how this piece would work, because there'd be not the context of knowing the city and knowing what actually happened. I'd probably have to rewrite something or give it a bit of more of a context as to, you know, how this stuff relates to today somehow.
I don't know. I might disagree with that, because I think that actually, I mean, everybody who's lived in a major metropolitan area has had to go through this. Our cities are constantly evolving, and you always are like, oh God, they've turned my favorite pub into a luxury hotel. Great. You know, my laundromat is now a Chinese restaurant. I think people see this happening everywhere, certainly in London, certainly in metropolitan areas. How it would fare in, say, a village hall.
Yeah, well, that's another thing. I'm not sure. It's a very urban piece, yeah. You know, and I think that's very deliberate, and I'm quite happy to live with that, I think.
Yeah. But I think it was really well done. Can you tell me a little bit about just Red Note in general, and because you've been working with them for some time, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, I've been working with Red Note in one way or another for a few years. The residency that I have with them, which actually ends at the end of this run, it's been a year and a bit. Which has been great fun. Red Note themselves aren't that old as an ensemble. It's only been a few years, I think. Basically, they are probably the foremost new music ensemble in Scotland, and they perform almost exclusively new music. And I was very lucky and honoured to be made their embedded composer in residence for the last year, which has led to Elbow Room. And they've given me quite a, you know, a full-on experience in that time. I mean, I've not just been writing, I've also been helping out with the ensemble. I've, you know, attended their rehearsals, I've helped out on education projects, I went with them to the Huddersfield Contemporary Music Festival, I have unloaded vans of percussion, I have reloaded vans of percussion, I've shifted music stands, I've done all the dog's body work for an ensemble. But I've learned an awful lot about the music, you know. I learned a lot about how the ensemble works and how ensembles generally work in a way that I don't think I can quite put my finger on what it is exactly I found out by this, but it certainly has informed the way I write somehow.
I love the fact that you were embedded, like a military reporter.
The scheme was created by an organization in London called Sound and Music, who, amongst many things, pair up emerging composers with renowned music ensembles. But yeah, the word embedded is theirs. And yes, it does come from the Pentagon, I think, originally.
That's so weird. If people want to find out more about Red Note performances and just more, hear some music and all of the other things you can find on a website, you can go to rednoteensemble.com. Or, of course, you can find them on the Facebook and Twitter and stuff. Thomas, if people want to find out more about your work, hear some things, where could they go?
They go to my website, which is thomas-butler.co.uk.
And, of course, we've been listening to some of your tracks underneath this interview and interspersed. Thank you so much, Thomas.
Well, thank you.
Everybody, go check out more of Thomas's work and, of course, the work of Red Note. We're really excited to announce that we'll be doing a live Culture Laser once again, this time in the beautiful city of Berlin. We're going to be there on the 8th of June. We've got a band lined up. We've got two live bands lined up, a lot of old friends. I'm going to bring some Buckfast over. I'm really, really, really looking forward to it. If you're in Berlin, you happen to be listening to this, the event is going to be on the 8th of June. It's at Altes Finanzamt at 8 p.m. Please come along. We'll be revealing more details about the whole event very, very soon. And we'll put it up on our webpage and stuff. Can't wait to see you there. Can't wait to do it live. And we're going to leave you now with a little snippet from what I like to call Electro Motorway, the second act, where imagine you're driving a beautiful white 1971. What kind of car is it? Do you know?
No idea. I can't remember.
A beautiful white 1971 coupe. Little two-seater cruising down a beautiful, pristine motorway, full of optimism, hope, and looking forward to the future. This is a composition from Thomas Butler. Thank you so much, Thomas.
Thank you.
more.